This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Saudi Aramco started its initial public offering on Sunday, 7 weeks after crippling attacks on its oil facilities. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
Saudi Arabia kick-started an initial public offering of the world's largest oil company on Sunday, 3 years after a listing of Saudi Aramco was first flagged, and just 7 weeks after crippling attacks on its oil facilities. The IPO will be split into two tranches, one each for institutional and individual investors. Sources say Aramco could offer 1 to 2% of its shares, raising as much as $20 billion to $40 billion. The company is valued by bankers and company insiders at around $1.5 trillion, 50% more than the world's most valuable listed companies, Microsoft and Apple.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Anti-government protesters in Iraq's capital have shut down key roads. Schools and government offices are also closed in Baghdad and other Iraqi cities Sunday, the start of the work week in the Muslim-majority country. The demonstrators are demanding change in the country's political system. In Beirut, thousands of people turned out Sunday to show their support for Lebanon's president. The demonstration was held near the presidential palace in southeastern Beirut. The show of support for the country's president is in direct contrast to the protests demanding a complete overhaul of Lebanon's sectarian-based politics. Tens of thousands of Islamists at a protest camp in Pakistan's capital are awaiting a deadline set by their leader calling for the prime minister to resign. Cleric Maulana Fazlur Rahman led a caravan of supporters to Islamabad last week in a bid to pressure Imran Khan to step down, calling him an illegitimate ruler. Rahman has hinted he could direct his partisans to march on the seat of parliament and force Khan's resignation. This is VOA News. A French minister says the new Brexit deal of January 31st is not negotiable and the risk of a no-deal Brexit remains. AP's Aria Shackley reports.
Minister for European Affairs Amélie de Montchalin told Europe One Radio that she's advising French companies to continue preparing for a scenario in which Britain leaves the bloc on January the 31st without a divorce deal, despite getting a three-month Brexit extension from the European Union. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had promised to take Britain out of the EU by October 31st, with or without a deal, but the British Parliament blocked his plans. Now Britain is holding an election on the 12th of December, and Johnson hopes to get a more Brexit-friendly parliament. I'm Zaria Shakili.
Riot police stormed several malls in Hong Kong on Sunday to stop pro-democracy protests. However, violence did break out when a knife-wielding man slashed several people and bit off part of the ear of a local pro-democracy politician. Media reports say 5 people were injured, including 2 in critical condition. The White House is defending U.S. President Donald Trump's bid to get Ukraine to investigate one of his chief 2020 Democratic political rivals, former Vice President Joe Biden, saying the request did not amount to an impeachable offense. One of Mr. Trump's top aides, Kellyanne Conway, told CNN the president has done nothing to warrant impeachment. Meanwhile, on ABC's This Week, Republican Congressman Steve Scalise says House Democrats are intent on ousting President Trump.
They didn't negotiate with the White House on that resolution. Under Clinton and Nixon, there was a bipartisan negotiation to at least have fair rules. They don't want fair rules. They just want to hurt President Trump's chances to win re-election.
Democrat Elliot Engel defended the process, saying the Republicans and President Trump have the same rights as those in 2 previous presidential impeachments.
They have the same due process rights that we've had in the Nixon and the Clinton impeachments. You know, they can. We took depositions for several weeks. They complained about that. This week, we're releasing the transcripts of all the depositions, and everything else is going to be public.
If that full House on a simple majority vote approves articles of impeachment against Mr. Trump in the coming weeks, a trial would be held in the Republican-majority Senate, where a 2/3 vote would be needed to convict him and remove him from office. A federal judge has blocked a Trump administration rule requiring immigrants prove they will have health insurance or can pay for medical care before they get visas. 7 U.S. citizens and a nonprofit organization filed the federal lawsuit Wednesday contending the rule would block nearly 2/3 of all prospective legal immigrants. For more on any of today's news, please visit us at voanews.com or download the VOA mobile app for news on the go. In Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
For From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor for Newsweek, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The impeachment inquiry into President Trump is accelerating with dramatic developments on several fronts. An election is set in Britain with the future of both Brexit and Prime Minister Boris Johnson on the line, and Facebook under fire. We'll talk about the social media giant. There are growing calls in both the U.S. and Europe for some sort of crackdown. Well, let's start, Jonathan and Kimberly, with this impeachment inquiry into President Trump accelerating rapidly here in the United States. And just this week, the Democrats who control the House of Representatives passed some rules that will take all of this into the next phase, a very public phase that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, says is designed to sort of let the American public see what the evidence is that's being accumulated against President Trump. This is almost exactly a totally partisan vote on both sides. Sum up for us what happened this week, Kimberly.
So that was a really pivotal moment in this ongoing impeachment inquiry, because one of the main Republican arguments against this inquiry thus far, which I should say is not the actual impeachment that may come later depending on how this goes, was that the process was flawed. Now, the process had been going as previous impeachment inquiries had gone, where various committees in the House of Representatives were interviewing witnesses and things like this. But this formal vote on this process and the rules around it kind of take the wind out of that argument for Republicans, and also for the Democrats kind of identify who's going to do what. It identifies which committee heads are going to be doing what and what rights the Republicans have in terms of bringing in witnesses. In addition, it also gives more clarity to what the president and his legal team can do.
Kimberly made a good point when she said that the Republicans, Jonathan, for the longest time have said, look, there's no transparency to this. It's a sham. It's a witch hunt, whatever phrase they want to use. Well, now all of this is going to be out in the open, and the Republicans, for the first time, are going to have to talk about not the process that they've been attacking, but the facts and the substance and the evidence that has been accumulated against the president. That's a very stark change.
Yes. As Kimberly said, they were focusing only on process up until now. But now that argument has been taken away from them, or that point has been taken away from them, by the fact that this is now going into the public phase of this inquiry. A strategy seems to be developing where the Republicans, both in Congress and the White House, are essentially saying that what the president did was perfectly fine, that what he was really asking the Ukrainians to do was to look into corruption and to make sure that American aid dollars to Ukraine are being spent wisely. So they're trying to broaden the issue away from a specific request to look into Trump's political enemies or political rivals and to make it an issue of corruption.
Well, another argument you're starting to hear is this narrative that the Democrats are trying to undermine the democracy by pushing this in an inquiry and potentially articles of impeachment and a case in the Senate, which is where it would go, that would overlap an election campaign and happen in an election year. And so now you're also seeing this, oh, they just don't want the American people to vote, and so they're trying to remove that opportunity. That narrative is being sort of tested out in early phases at this point as well. But I think you are having seen the Republicans struggle a great deal to make these arguments on the facts of the matter, because as more and more, in the case of this week, sometimes sitting White House officials are coming in and corroborating some of the more serious allegations that are out there, it's making it much harder for the Republicans to go against the facts.
And on that point, let's talk briefly about some of these charges that are coming out. There's really sort of a flood of big names testifying on the Hill before Congress about what the president is accused of doing. A couple of people saying, look, there was a quid pro quo. Either I heard it or I was briefed on it. Another gentleman for military aid said that they clearly tried to doctor the transcript of the call between the president and Mr. Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. And President Trump is always saying, well, look at the transcript. There's nothing at the transcript that indicates that there was a quid pro quo or anything wrong. And these guys say, well, that's because they doctored the transcript. They left out key things that they didn't want in there. So
it does say the transcript is not actually a transcript on document.
That's right. So that appears, that to me sounds like a bit of a cover-up.
Yes. And what's happening here is that the witnesses that are coming in, that are testifying, are virtually impeachable. I mean, one of them was a lieutenant colonel, an immigrant from the Ukraine, who has devoted his entire professional life to service for the United States. And he's the one who actually listened in on the phone call and corroborated exactly what the whistleblower initially said. So what you see now is President Trump calling him a never Trumper, essentially trying to smear his reputation, which I think makes the administration look very, very bad.
Just to give our listeners a little background, you're talking about a gentleman named Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. He's a Ukraine expert on the National Security Council. And to your point, he served in Iraq, served in Afghanistan, and he...
And was wounded in
Iraq.
It
has been reported, Purple Heart winner for being wounded in combat. And to this day, CNN has reported, still has shrapnel in his body from that combat. It's awfully hard to attack the patriotism of someone who has that kind of record.
It's worth noting both Republican and Democrat members of Congress quickly came out after the president's criticisms of him in his defense.
Anybody who says something that is even remotely critical of him while he's an ever-Trumper or he's just working on behalf of some other country or something like that, I mean, open, honest criticism, he just seems to chafe at no matter from what quarter it comes.
Yes, exactly. And there were other witnesses that came forward and testified this week who basically, again, corroborated exactly what the whistleblower said. And I think one of the reasons why this impeachment inquiry is moving into this public phase is because the Democrats now feel confident with this kind of testimony from witnesses that they can make a compelling case.
It's interesting also that these charges that are slowly but surely being compiled by the Democrats in the House, it concerns more than this Ukraine situation and this alleged quid pro quo. You might remember the Mueller report from a couple of months ago. The president says, well, no obstruction, no collusion. Of course, that's not true because the Mueller report listed at least 10 allegations of obstruction. Those have not gone away. And you can be sure, Kimberly, that they're going to be taking a closer look at all of that, too.
Right. And what was hidden, what was moved around in order to potentially protect the president from further investigation? Mueller, when he finished his report and when he was sort of dragged in front of Congress against his will to testify, his point was that he was not absolving the president of anything, but it was not his role to criminally prosecute the president of the United States. That was his interpretation of the law, was that that was not something he could do. He's like, here's what I found. You're Congress. It's your job. Do with it what you want. So we will probably see more of that bubbling back to the surface, especially as it relates to efforts by people within the Trump administration to try to suppress information or potentially if they have lied to Congress.
And so it's not just Ukraine stuff, but it could be just a long list of charges that the president conceivably could face here. What happens next year, Jonathan, in this process, and what's sort of the timeline attached to it?
What happens is that the hearings that are going on the Hill, which had been closed, they will now be open. The Intelligence Committee will hold public hearings and witnesses will come forward. The American people will get to hear what they have to say. Many of these witnesses have already testified, so we know essentially what they're going to say, but their remarks have come out through the media and through leaks. Now the public will get a chance to actually hear with their own ears what they've been saying behind closed doors.
Without being filtered by the media.
Exactly. And then what will happen is that all of this information that has come out will then be given over to the Judiciary Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, which on the basis of what they hear and what the president and his lawyers argue in their own defense and what Republicans say in their questioning of these witnesses, on the basis of that, that will be turned over to the Judiciary Committee. And then the Judiciary Committee will decide whether they're going to write articles of impeachment. They hope to have this wrapped up in terms of a timeline by Thanksgiving.
Which is just less than a month away.
Less than a month away. So it's a very, very fast-track process. It's not clear that they'll actually get things done by then, but that is the goal.
Now, beyond that, Kimberly, sort of the political ramifications of this were the 2020 campaign is well underway, a whole bunch of Democrats still in the race here, and the conventional wisdom, I'm often skeptical of that, but the conventional wisdom is that Republicans say, well, this is going to galvanize President Trump. They've been raising a bunch of money off of this, and it will sort of anger Republicans to go to the polls. Why wouldn't this also galvanize Democrats who don't like the president?
I think the Democrats who don't like the president are already as galvanized as they're going to be for a litany of other things done by the Trump administration that upsets Democrats, whether it be his actions on immigration or lack of actions related to climate change, health care, pick your issue. There are plenty of reasons for Democrats to be angry at the president. The president is successfully using impeachment to really rally his base. They're selling witch hunt merchandise as campaign items. The other issue that this might bring into the 2020 campaign is just that it sucks up all the oxygen. This is at a moment when Democratic candidates are trying to get traction, trying to get their name out there, and all of the headlines aren't their latest campaign proposals, it's impeachment. And at the same time, you have candidates who are members of both the House of Representatives and senators who might potentially have to vote on articles of impeachment, and then they would have to be in Washington, not on the campaign trail.
What are the polls, either of you can answer this one, what are the polls in general saying about all of this?
The nationwide poll shows that there is a majority of Americans who favor impeachment and favor removal from office. However, within Trump's base, he is still very, very popular and very, very strong. So what it really boils down to is which particular states, what the polling numbers there show. I mean, there are roughly six or seven battleground states where the election will be decided. And what's very important is how the folks in those states feel about impeachment.
Yeah. Now, for folks listening quickly here, I mean, as Jonathan said, of the 50 states, the election is really going to come down to just a handful of them in places like Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, perhaps Virginia, those kind. Mm. All the other states, it's pretty much known based on current polls and also history, frankly, how most of these states are going to vote. So very interesting point. Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor for Newsweek, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson won support for a snap election. The House of Commons voting overwhelmingly 438-20 to dissolve Parliament and launch a six-week election campaign. Imagine running a campaign in just 6 weeks. At stake here, Brexit, the three-year effort to leave the European Union. It's also a huge gamble for Johnson himself, of course, who puts his own job on the line. Now, he could go down in history, perhaps, depending on how this goes, as the prime minister who finally, two failed prime ministers were unable to do this, to take Britain out of the European Union, or become the shortest serving prime minister, I think, in about two centuries. What's going to happen here?
Well, I think it's worth noting first that we're recording this the day after he swore up and down Britain was definitely going to exit the European Union. Of course, that did not happen. The EU granted an extension, which he didn't want to take, and the parliament forced him to do it. It's all complicated. So now he's trying with this election to sort of garner more support, to prove that if the conservatives conservatives can win even more seats, that he's got the backing to get out of Brexit the way that he wants to. I don't know. This thing just keeps repeating over and over again. Jonathan was saying earlier, it sounds like Groundhog's Day every time, which in the United States is a holiday we celebrate. We're, you know, anyway, it's a movie
reference. Same thing happens
Same thing happens every single day.
You said getting out of Brexit the way he wants to. What is the way he wants to?
I think what he wants is either some sort of deal that would keep the border between the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland open so that traffic and goods and people can cross that border without...
They're major trade partners, those two neighbors.
Yes, exactly. The Republic of Ireland is a member of the EU. If the United Kingdom pulls out, there's a border, a land border, between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland. So that is the only place where there's an actual land border between an EU country and a non-EU country, assuming that the UK pulls out.
And speaking of trade issues, President Trump, and we just can't stop talking about him, he sort of inserted himself into this earlier this week when he called into a radio show the head of the Brexit party and was saying that he'd actually didn't like the plan that Boris Johnson had for Brexit and that it was going to make it hard for the U.S. to do a trade deal with the U.K. under those terms. Now, why is that important? Because the whole argument for Brexit is that Britain will be better off economically on its own than from the EU, and that would be incredibly reliant on having a really good trade deal with the US. So for President Trump to sort of step in and say that this deal that Boris Johnson is pushing wouldn't be good for that could potentially be quite damaging to his campaign.
Yeah, it's interesting that President Trump, who claims to be friends with Prime Minister Johnson, did him no favors by calling in. I think it was Nigel Farage's radio show. So talk about getting involved in foreign elections.
This is a classic Trumpian move. I mean, when he sees that his potential interlocutor in any negotiation over a bilateral trade agreement between the United States and Britain, when he sees that that figure is essentially under pressure, on the ropes, going into an election where the results may be uncertain. In other words, he's weak. So what does Trump do? He plays his hand. He goes right in and he says, oh, this may not be the best thing. I'm going to add more pressure to you. So he, in this case, tries to strengthen his own hand, Trump's hand, in advance of any negotiation.
It's sort of the equivalent of like Boris Johnson phoning into a radio show here and saying something negative about the president. It's just kind of odd for him to do that.
I don't think it's quite the same, because President Trump doesn't really rely on good trade deal with Boris Johnson for the future of his presidency. And so he definitely has a stronger negotiating position in this moment. And I think that he's really, as Jonathan said, playing to that.
It's interesting that this whole Brexit thing has been going on for about 3.5 years now. I mean, originally passed, I think, in the summer of 2016, very narrowly, about 52% now. And I wonder, what is the sort of number of Britons who now favor it? It seems to be getting friends. I just got back from overseas, and friends there saying, well, we're just tired of the whole thing. I wish it would just, one way or another, just go away.
Well, one of the reasons why people believe that the election might be decisive in this case is because...
Decisive in favor of Johnson?
Of resolving the issue is because the conservatives are expected to win more seats. And if they do, as Kimberly said, they will leave the way Johnson prefers. However, if the Labour Party wins, if the public disgust or lack of excitement about this anymore, basically want to just get this thing off their plates, if the Labour Party wins, the Labour Party is banking their election chances on calling a second referendum, where the public would get to actually vote whether they want to leave the EU or not. In other words, a second go at it.
And it's worth noting that one of the reasons the Labour Party has been pushing for a second referendum for so long is this argument that the British public now has more information about what Brexit would actually mean in terms of economic impact, in terms of the challenges of working with the EU, the fact that the deal isn't as good as what was promised during the original campaign. And so this is their argument, that the British public did not get a full or honest picture about what Brexit would mean, and therefore we should have have a second referendum. Obviously, the pro-Brexiters disagree with that strongly.
One thing, as we before we move on here, that seems to be giving Johnson a boost, and polls, in fact, do show that he's likely to get his way in this election, and as you say, add more seats in the House of Commons, which will give him the leverage that he needs. It's probably helpful that his opponent, the Labour candidate, Jeremy Corbyn, is not polling well. A lot of the proposals that he has put out, far left kind of things that, at least according to surveys there, are really putting off a lot of British voters who are nowhere near far to the left as he is.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Corbyn is not very popular. And if the polls are to be believed, then I think Johnson is going to win.
Well, let's move on here. Social media now plays a huge role in political campaigns, not just here in the United States, but elsewhere. Messages for or against a candidate or issue. The problem, of course, is that a lot of these messages are false and inflammatory, and platforms like Facebook and Twitter have come under fire for allowing such messages to proliferate and spread easily. Now, for this reason, Twitter just this week said that it would ban political advertising. Facebook, though, says it will continue to allow it. It's making a whole bunch of money off of this, claims such things are free speech, even though some of these ads are clearly not true. Kimberly, what do you think?
It's been just incredibly challenging for these big tech companies to walk this fine line between saying that they support free speech, but also saying that they want to clamp down on manipulating elections. Facebook is particularly sensitive to this, since, as we know from every single national security agency in the United States, the Russians very effectively used Facebook during the 2016 elections to sort of manipulate many American people. And so Facebook has come down on, you know what? Not our problem. We're just going to step back and let it play. We're going to go after state actors that are interfering in the elections of others, but we're not going to try to police what real candidates or real organizations or real people are saying, even if it's demonstrably false and even if it's spreading like wildfire. Twitter instead is taking the complete opposite stance, washing its hands of the whole thing in a different way and just saying, we're not going to allow it at all.
Yeah. If I just may add something here, although Facebook did come out with some policies going forward where they're actually going to allow whoever to put things up on Facebook, but what they're going to do is they're going to flag, as a result of their own fact checkers, advertisements or postings that are false.
Well, they claim to have hired some 35,000 people who, that's all they do, is try and sift through stuff and determine what's false and what's not false.
Right. And what happens, what you'll see on the Facebook page, is that the information will appear, but there'll be a very, very large gray square that basically says this is false information according to our fact checkers. Now, how effective that can be, I mean, you know, you can catch, it's just like smuggling drugs. I mean, you catch, what, 10% of the drugs coming into the country? It's the same way with speech.
It sounds like a warning on a cigarette box. These cigarettes are bad for you and people smoke them anyway.
Right.
Although cigarette smoking rates have declined since when these labels
That's
get
true.
Put on. Right. So, but another thing that, as Jonathan was kind of alluding to, is the implementation of this is going to be extraordinarily challenging, both for Twitter and for Facebook. And these are companies that are already facing criticism from conservatives that their views are being suppressed unfairly on these platforms. President Trump has criticized Twitter's move, although Lindsey Graham apparently came out in support of it. He's a very high-ranking Republican member of Congress. And so at the end of the day, these are private companies deciding who gets to say what on their site. And that's always going to be controversial. And Twitter is going to find itself in particular danger if it opens itself up to the accusations that the ads it does allow end up being supportive of more liberal causes, and the ads that it really cracks down on are the ones that support conservative causes. Now, I should also mention the money angle of this. I think Twitter made, I don't know, maybe a couple dozen millions of dollars off these political ads. Facebook makes hundreds of millions of dollars off political ads. So the risk-reward balance is also different for the two companies.
It's interesting that sort of in this age of people not trusting media, Facebook is one thing that people do tend to trust because, as Kimberly said, who they follow, if you get something from your friend or family or relative, you may be more inclined to believe it than before. We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Jonathan Broder, he's contributing editor at Newsweek, and Kimberly Adams, she's the Washington correspondent for Marketplace. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Joe Gill, and I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thanks for joining us.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is journalist Sam Dagher. He's the author of a groundbreaking new book entitled Assad or We Burn the Country, How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria. Sam Dagher reported in the Middle East for more than 15 years, most recently for The Atlantic. He was the only non-Syrian reporter for a major Western media outlet based in Damascus from 2012 to 2014, a period during which a pro-Assad militia arrested and briefly held him in an underground mukhabarat, or secret police prison. He was later expelled from Syria for reporting deemed unfavorable to the regime. The war in Syria is the defining conflict of this decade. From its origins in peaceful demonstrations for political reform, the confrontation between the Assad regime and its opponents evolved through harsh repression and the militarization and radicalization of some of the opposition into a regional and global proxy war. The Syrian regime has routinely committed war crimes and crimes against humanity, making a mockery of international hopes to protect civilians against atrocities. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad consistently attacked civilians and the moderate armed opposition, as he and his allies, Iran, Hezbollah, and Russia, saw them as the most potent threat to the regime's survival. Bashar helped to bolster the jihadists, including the so-called Islamic State. He managed to stay in power thanks to starvation campaigns that he inflicted on civilians and the remnants of the Free Syria Army and the vacuum left by the so-called Friends of Syria, an informal group of Western democracies whose lack of political will played right into the hands of Russia and Iran, allowing Bashar al-Assad to prevail. He has displaced half the population. 8 years of civil war have destroyed the economy, cost 500,000 lives, and spawned the worst refugee crisis since the end of World War II. Sam Dagher's book, Assad or We Burn the Country, gives a vivid and powerful account of the roots and the course of the conflict, setting it in the context of Assad's personal history and approach to power. Sam shows how one of the world's most vicious police states came to be and explains how a regional conflict extended globally. And Sam Dagher joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Mabruk, congratulations on this exceptional, groundbreaking book. What prompted you to tell this story and to start by doing so through the lens of a relationship between the Assad and Talas families?
As you mentioned in the introduction, I had the opportunity to live and work in Syria between 2012 and 2014. So I bore witness to the regime's strategy of pretty much crushing this uprising that started purely as peaceful protests. And then as a result of his decision to kill people from the very moment he took to the streets, day after day, it morphed into an armed conflict. I was there late 2012. It was already a conflict, a war, but by being inside Damascus, I got to observe firsthand the regime's counterinsurgency strategy, what the regime was doing on the ground obviously with tremendous help from key allies, Iran and Hezbollah. At the time, Russia was providing political backing at the UN, vetoing all the resolutions. But the powers on the ground were mainly Iran and Hezbollah, helping him come up with this strategy to regain territory. So I was seeing the sieges of all these opposition communities in Damascus and Homs and elsewhere, basically starving these communities into submission. I was seeing with my own eyes the sectarian militias that had been created by the regime to fill the gap in the army, because if you remember at the beginning of the uprising, his army unraveled. A lot of the Sunni soldiers and junior officers either deserted or defected rather than shoot their own people, because that's what the regime was asking them to do. So I was there to see how these militias were stood up and what the regime was doing with the help from Iran and Hezbollah, and also seeing the aftermath of a lot of horrific massacres that the regime was committing. And more importantly, I came in contact with the militia leaders that were tasked by the regime to carry out this campaign. I mean, that was extraordinary, because any reporter coming in is dealing with the official bodies, the Ministry of Information, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But I got to deal with the henchmen. I mean, came in contact with them and got to hear from them directly their unabashed determination to crush, you know, this uprising by any means. So 2 years in there, I come out in 2014. I don't come out of my own free will. They kick me out. And I see the world just focused on ISIS and almost saying, well, Bashar is maybe better than ISIS and we have to focus on ISIS. And there was by then an attempt to almost rewrite the history of this whole uprising by the regime and its supporters, primarily Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, and the Iraqis. So I felt I had an obligation to write this history down and make sure people really know how it all started and the root causes and how it became, you know, the war it did.
Speaking of root causes, Sam, let's go back to those root causes, because you start the book by telling about the relationship between Talas and Assad family. So let's go back and talk about that relationship, because that posed a choice for Bashar al-Assad when this uprising occurred in the wake of the Arab Spring back in 2011. Talk about that relationship and why Bashar al-Assad chose to crack down as opposed to maybe compromise, as your book says the Talas clan suggested he should do.
About the relationship between the two families, the patriarchs, Hafez al-Assad and Mustafa Talas, met when they were at the military academy in Homs in their early 20s. So they rose to power together. So Mustafa Talas was by Hafez al-Assad's side when he grabbed power through a coup in 1970, and he was his defense minister. And Mustafa Talas was by Hafez al-Assad's side throughout the 30 years that followed, particularly when the regime, 7 years after the coup, people started protesting in Syria against, you know, the regime, because initially Assad came to power by trying to promise Syrians that he was going to open up the country, he was going to allow for some measure of economic liberalization, this is the father, and also to allow for some margin of political freedom and to open up Syria to the rest of the world. So people embraced him at the time, particularly the Damascene clergy and the businessmen. But then 7 years into it, they realized that he was only interested in building this cultish dictatorship. So people started rising up across Syria, students, university professors, professionals, workers, because the economy was starting to do very poorly, inflation was rampant, and there was corruption, of course, and these types of regimes, we know what happens when a clique is ruling and these crony capitalists emerge. And at the same time, you know, this public discontent is happening. There is an Islamist insurgency that is targeting members of the Alawite community. This is the minority to which Hafez al-Assad belongs. So going back to Mustafa Talas, his friend, he is by his side as Hafez al-Assad launches, you know, a crackdown against everyone. Everyone is labeled a terrorist, whether you're an Islamist insurgent or a peaceful protester or somebody who's calling for a strike against the government. So he basically manages over several periods to bludgeon the Syrian people into submission. And it all culminates in a horrific massacre in the city of Hama in 1982. And remember, Mustafa Atlas is by the side of his friend throughout all of this, basically approving all of his friend's moves because he was at the helm of the defense ministry, all the troop movements, everything that happened during that period. So at that point, Hafez al-Assad realizes that he needs to rely more on his sect. So you see the Alawites taking over key positions in the army and the security services. So it becomes a much more sectarian regime, but the Atlas family is there, and the Atlas family almost provides that cover that he's in partnership with the Sunnis, and look, he has Sunnis in power next to him. Then fast forward to the son, who takes over in 2000. The Atlas family plays a prominent role in the passage of power from Hafez to his son, almost like a monarchy, basically. You had the king die, and then, you know, his crown prince take over, and the Atlas family's there, and they're there to help market Bashar to the Syrian people as this young reformer. And they're with him throughout that period. But then the uprising begins, and that's when Manaf Atlas, the son of Mustafa Atlas, who had been Bashar al-Assad's childhood friend, reaches a crossroads. You know, does he do the same thing that his own father did, you know, stand by the regime as it kills its own people? He realizes that times are different and that he couldn't be like his father, and tries to convince Bashar al-Assad to negotiate with the rebellious communities. But Bashar al-Assad and those around him remember what happened under the reign of Hafez, that they needed to be very tough from the beginning. In fact, they were looking at it from the lens of the 70s and 80s. And Manaf says they take out the Hama manual from the drawer, this manual on how to crush this type of uprising. And I would say the guiding principle of this manual is the title of the book, Assad or We Burn the Country. Either they prevail and stay in power, or the country is destroyed.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is journalist Sam Dagher. He's author of the recently published book, Assad or We Burn the Country, How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal fan from Abia State, Nigeria, Okuru Blessing Chibuki. Well, back to our guest, the author of Assad or We Burn the Country, Sam Dagher. Well, Sam, so we left off talking about how Bashar al-Assad refused the advice of the son of Mustafa Atlas, Manaf Atlas, tried to get Bashar al-Assad from actually cracking down on these protesters. But Bashar decided to keep within the tradition of the Assad family, using violence to stay in power at all costs. So we see then the peaceful protesters being knocked off by snipers. They're trying to maintain a peaceful protest, but becomes almost impossible unless they are willing to just lay down and die. So there was then this need for defense. We see a defection from the Syrian army. The defectors became known as the Free Syria Army. Talk about what was the tipping point for them, and then what happened with them after that, and the struggle that they had in trying to fight the remainder of the regime's army.
So day after day, week after week, the regime was killing protesters on the streets. Every attempt by the protesters to occupy a square, just like what happened, if you remember, in Egypt, in Tahrir Square in Cairo, people thought that if they could amass in a public space possibly 100,000, even a million, that there would be strength in numbers and that the regime wouldn't dare kill them because all the world would be watching and the regime would think twice about doing that. And there were several attempts in Damascus, but they ended in utter carnage. I mean, people were shot on the streets as they were making the way towards one of the main squares in Damascus, Abbasin Square. There was an attempt in Homs. Actually, people occupied a square there. Homs is the third largest city. But immediately, the regime gathered, you know, soldiers and thugs and even university students that were loyal to the regime and basically attacked the protesters, and hundreds were killed. Ultimately, the protesters did occupy a square in Hama, another major city. And at one point, the protests were attracting almost a million people, and they were calling for Bashar to leave power because already, you know, by August, he had killed hundreds of people. And the U.S., you know, expressed support for these protests in Hama, but again, did nothing to protect them. And hundreds of people were killed, and Bashar al-Assad took over Hama again. And at that point, a lot of people in Syria, particularly the ones on the ground, realized that they had to take matters into their own hand. This is already like late summer, early fall, that they needed to protect their communities from these constant incursions by the regime. I mean, the regime would go in and just kill people who were protesting on the street. So they began to, I mean, it was just people in the neighborhood who carried arms and tried to protect the protests. And then a lot of the defectors organized a loose kind of coalition of rebels called the Free Syrian Army. Again, very little support. But then some countries in the region that had specific agendas, like Turkey and Qatar, who were seeing the Arab Spring as an opportunity to bring in their Muslim Brotherhood allies, began supporting them with money, with weapons. And at that point, obviously, because there was a void, the U.S. didn't want to do anything. There was a vacuum. Saudi Arabia also stepped in. So you began to have this sort of competition between these regional powers over who was going to control the FSA.
Exactly. And of course, initially, interestingly, Turkish Prime Minister, then Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, was rather friendly with Bashar al-Assad. They presumably went on vacation together, but he was unable to convince Bashar al-Assad to stop the violence. And as you just said, there was this scramble. You had the Turks, you had the Qataris, and then the Saudis, each one trying to split the opposition and arm those that they felt were able to achieve their objectives. And their objectives were probably, well, we need to get rid of Assad, but then what? Saudi Arabia is no fan of democracy, Turkey at that time also, nor Qatar. And then, as you said, the void by the United States and the so-called Friends of Syria, this was this conglomerate of democracies, right, European primarily. What about the role of Russia? Because I think that is crucial. Every time a resolution to condemn the Assad regime and maybe do something by the West, they had a veto on the Security Council. And that seemed to also deter the West from doing anything, which is extremely unfortunate.
Absolutely. I mean, oftentimes people say the Russians felt betrayed over Libya because, you know, they had backed a resolution that was mainly for the protection of civilians, but that was used by the U.S. and its allies to launch, you know, a bombing campaign against Gaddafi's forces and to support, you know, the rebels in that country. But I think it goes beyond that, because really the Arab Spring was a threat to Putin directly, because you have to remember there were protests in Russia right around that time. And Putin felt he had to go in and neutralize this. I mean, it is the traditional Soviet Union, and then Russia is seen as the traditional ally of the Syrian regime. But by then, beyond the naval base in Tartus and the fact that the Russians had helped build the Syrian army, you couldn't say like Russia was like the protector of the Syrian regime. Iran was a much more important ally at the time. But Russia really saw an opportunity to go in because it was observing. It was looking at the U.S., U.S. in retreat, not wanting to be involved anywhere, pulling out of Iraq, you know, saying that Bashar al-Assad had to go, but doing nothing. So it felt this was really an opportunity for it to go in to amplify its presence in Syria, use Syria as basically a staging ground to challenge the U.S. and its allies and project power. And in fact, that was what Putin said in a speech to his diplomats. I think it was around the spring or summer of 2012. He said, those days of Russia just sitting and observing and watching are over. We have to go in there and be involved in things on the ground.
And of course, how coincidental, just at the time when President Barack Obama was saying the opposite, we need to leave. He took the troops out of Iraq. He was not inclined, as you said, to get involved in Syria. Even the half-hearted attempts by the Pentagon and the CIA to arm the Free Syrian Army were unsuccessful. It's almost as if they were meant to fail. And then, of course, he was in a re-election campaign in 2012. I believe that may have been a factor in him not wanting to do more, just as his advisors, General David Petraeus of the CIA, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, all were saying we really need to support the Syrian opposition against this dictator and tyrant who is killing his innocent citizens in a barbaric way. And this was even before the so-called red line, the chemical weapons attack. So let's go back quickly, though, and look at Bashar al-Assad's relationship with Iran. Bashar al-Assad and his family are part of the minority Alawites, which is a sect of Shiism. And of course, Iran is predominantly Shia. And to what extent do you think this was a factor? And how much of a decisive factor did Iran and its militias, that is Hezbollah in particular, play in basically propping up Bashar al-Assad and helping him prevail.
The relationship between the Syrian regime and Iran, really, to be more specific, the Islamic Republic of Iran, goes back to the basically inception of the Islamic Republic in 1979. A few years before that, Hafez al-Assad was getting financial support from Saudi Arabia, from the U.S. Actually, the U.S. gave Syria almost $700 million in the money of that period. And also, the U.S. encouraged Hafez al-Assad to go into Lebanon to protect the Christians and to rein in what the U.S. saw at the time as PLO fanatics and people tied to the Soviet Union and communists in Lebanon. So they actually encouraged Hafez al-Assad to go into Lebanon, and he did in 76. And all of this was happening also in the context of U.S. efforts to broker Arab-Israeli peace. You had the Camp David, you know, accords and all of that. But then Hafez began to feel that he was being cornered by the West, and his relationship with Saudi Arabia was not as good as it used to be. So he felt he needed new allies. And then the Islamic Republic of Iran appears, and he immediately reaches out to them, and they begin to form this alliance. Because you have to remember, the Iranians are in a region that's predominantly Sunni. They're Shia. And Hafez al-Assad is in a country that's predominantly Sunni, and he's an Alawite. So there's like a meeting of the minds. I mean, they're both from minorities and majority sort of environment. And then they begin to work together in Lebanon, where basically Hafez al-Assad is a key partner of Iran in creating and grooming Hezbollah. And the IRGC commanders are there training Hezbollah under sort of the supervision of the Syrian regime. So in this relationship, the Syrian regime always had the upper hand, basically, that Iran couldn't do anything in Lebanon without having to go through Hafez al-Assad and the Syrian regime. The whole dynamic changed when Bashar took over, because you have to remember, this young 35-year-old
ophthalmologist.
He was an ophthalmologist. He didn't want to actually become the president of Syria. He wanted to live in London and work over there and get married and never come back to Syria again. But then when his eldest brother died in a car crash, he came back, and he was never his father's favorite. So he had to learn, you know, how to become the ruler of Syria. And in the beginning, he needed a lot of help. He needed a lot of allies. And that's where Iran and Hezbollah saw an opportunity. The relationship evolved even further when Bashar was accused of murdering the prime minister of Lebanon in 2005. And that's really when Bashar needed the protection of Iran and Hezbollah. At that point, they go in. All the doors are opened in Damascus for Hezbollah and Iran after the assassination of Hariri. Syria begins to supply all these rockets to Hezbollah. Basically, they're delivered to Damascus by Iran, and they're supplied to Hezbollah. So really, the relationship becomes, the way I would describe it, is the Iranians and Hezbollah become part of the house of the Assads.
In the very few minutes we have left, I have two very important questions. What you said about the relationship between Iran and Syria underscores the statement by now-deceased Senator and war veteran John McCain. He said, in Syria, our interests and values converge, which is why many people are very upset that the United States didn't do more under President Obama to help. Because when we're saying Assad has to go, that could have also weakened Iran, which is considered an adversary in the region. But that's a different story. Talk quickly about Assad's strategy to stay in power at all costs. In addition to following through on the legacy of his father, brutality, he both placated and played the West, which was primarily concerned about Islamist terrorists, of course, in the post-9/11 era, and he presented himself as the stable one. Talk about how he let Islamist militants out of prison back in 2011, right? Knowing that they would wreak havoc and that the West would target these militants instead of seeing him as actually the very person who actually created Islamist threat.
You have to remember, Syria is a state sponsor of terrorism, according to the United States. It's on the list since that list was created in 1979. This regime has consistently used terrorism as a bargaining chip, as a way to blackmail and extort the U.S. and Europe. And they've done this consistently since the 1980s. They're basically the arsonists and the firemen at the same time. They've continued to play that role. After 9/11, Bashar presented himself to President George Bush as somebody who could be the U.S.'s partner in the war on terrorism. At one point, the infamous CIA rendition planes were stopping in Damascus to hand over al-Qaeda suspect to be tortured by Bashar al-Assad. But at some point, Bashar al-Assad realized that maybe he was going to be next after Saddam Hussein was toppled swiftly in 2003. So he began to support the insurgency in Iraq, including al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time, the budding franchise set up by Osama bin Laden. The jihadists were arriving by plane in Damascus, and they were driven by Bashar's security services to the border. There were training camps on the Syrian-Iraqi borders for jihadists. Then we conclude in 2006, the Iraq Study Report, that we had to come out of Iraq and we had to stabilize Iraq. And to do that, we needed the help of the Syrian regime. Again, the guy who was sending the terrorists there in the first place. So we begin this process of engagement with him, 2007, 8, 9, 10, where all the jihadists who were coming back from Iraq to Syria, he begins to round them up, put them in jail to show the Americans that he's actually cracking down on this problem and that he's helping them stabilize Iraq and to try to win some concessions from the U.S. The uprising begins. What does he do? These same people he releases, and they go on to reactivate all the al-Qaeda cells to create new extremist groups and to poison the uprising.
Exactly. And then they sort of work in tandem, that is, these Islamists and the Bashar al-Assad regime, because we know from the trajectory of the war that he almost never targeted them with barrel bombs or other air attacks. He was always targeting the biggest threat, the moderate opposition and civilians, which is really unbelievable that the West couldn't see through that.
Absolutely. But I would remind you, the father did exactly the same thing. He went after the peaceful protesters first. Those are the greatest threat to the regime. And even in 2018, when he declared that he won, what did he do? He executed a whole bunch of people in prison who had been peaceful activists there since 2011 and sent their families death notices.
At what junctures do you think could or should the West, the Friends of Syria, have defied Russia's veto of UN resolutions and acted decisively, not an invasion or a war or anything like that, channel funds and weapons to the Free Syria Army, helping at a diplomatic level? Instead, we all left a vacuum for Russia to intervene in 2015. Most diplomats and analysts say that unless you were able to make headway militarily on the ground, that's the only way you can have leverage at the negotiating table. But that never occurred, nor was a no-fly zone established, which could have saved thousands of lives.
Absolutely. I mean, on the no-fly zone, this was an idea supported by the Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, the Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, CIA Director Petraeus. They all said we would go a long way to protect people from the thing that was killing them the most, which is the bombs that were being dropped on them from Bashar al-Assad's warplanes. And all of the U.S. allies were pretty much on board. Everybody thought it was a great idea to basically protect people, save lives, and stem the tide of refugees. Because if you remember, people were fleeing to Turkey at the time, and having some sort of haven in the north would have gone a long way to protect people. But again, President Obama at the time saw it as a slippery slope towards an Iraq-like intervention, even though his advisors and members of his cabinet were saying otherwise. And you also mentioned, you know, the red line in 2013. And I know everybody focuses on that as the moment, but really the betrayal of the Syrian people began way before that.
Absolutely.
I mean, Bashar al-Assad crossed the red line at the end of 2012 by the U.S.'s own admission. I mean, U.S. came out in December in 2012 and said it suspects that he's already moving material to make chemical weapons and that he may have actually used it on one occasion in Homs. And then there were several occasions in the spring of 2013 when even our allies, France and Britain, said that he actually used it. So I would say the decision not to get involved was made long before that moment, the summer of 2013.
Just as we close briefly, Sam, as you see with Assad having prevailed, the country destroyed, half the population out of the country, how do you see things going forward with these supposed negotiations under the UN auspices?
I think it's the greatest gift to Bashar al-Assad because the regime has played this game from the get-go, basically telling the world, I'll take part in negotiations in Geneva, but using this time basically to plan how to remain in power. Yes, he's still there, but he's somebody who's wholly dependent on Russia and Iran. Without them, the regime would collapse.
What are the implications or consequences for the United States, for other democracies, the failure of them to really help Syria? And also, what about the refugees who are in Turkey or Europe or elsewhere, yearning to go back to their homeland, but not seeing a possibility as long as Bashar al-Assad remains in power.
Yeah, I mean, if our priority is to solve the refugee crisis and to stop people from leaving the Middle East, I don't think we're achieving that by helping Bashar al-Assad remain in power for another 7 years when his term expires in 2021. Ponder this for a moment. There are 7.1 million Syrians outside of Syria, so a third of the population is outside the country. Most of them won't go back as long as Assad is in power. What kind of fair elections can be held with a third of the population outside the country? Number one. Number two, framing this now as a political or constitutional crisis and forgetting about all the war crimes that were committed primarily by the regime. I mean, you have at least 500,000 people killed. The UN stopped counting in 2016. The vast majority of them were killed by the regime. Just forgetting all of that and not putting justice and accountability front and center should scare all of us, because this is sending a message to all dictators around the world. You can do that. You can kill your own people to stay in power. You can do anything to remain in power, and nobody's going to come after you. It's really a very scary message that we're sending.
The book is Assad or We Burn the Country: How One Family's Lust for Power Destroyed Syria. The author, Sam Dagher. Sam, congratulations again on this very important book, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Zubair Al-Tayeb. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.